Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Andrew Brennan, Dunbar High, class of 2014, went on to earn a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a Master of Education in Education Policy and Management from Harvard. He will be attending Columbia University this fall as a first-year law student. Andrew has made a deep-seated commitment to racial justice and civil rights with a focus on promoting more just and democratic Kentucky public schools. And that's the world of the Kentucky Student Voice Team, which Andrew co-founded, and he chairs its board. He also serves as Finance and Audit Chair of the Kentucky Higher Education Assistance Authority Board of Directors, and at the national education level, chairs Seek Common Grounds Board of Directors. In 2021, Andrew was recognized as a Forbes magazine's 30 Under 30 People to Watch, and in May was one of 10 black law students from around the country, awarded the Marshall Motley Scholarship from the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund, which will afford him the ability to practice civil rights law in the South for the foreseeable future. Andrew Brennan, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you very much for having me.
And after reading that bio, which is really impressive, I have to ask, is it true that you're just 27?
Yes, it is. It is the case. But, you know, I've been involved in this work since I was a high school student, just getting involved with the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence back in 2012. I mean, the truth is, I know a lot of high school students around the state who are taking action to create more just and democratic schools, and I was just one of them at the time.
And so you grew up here in Lexington?
Yeah, well, we moved around throughout the South a lot when I was younger, but my family moved here when I was in eighth grade. My dad became the first African-American dean of the University of Kentucky Law School, and so my family and I moved here and, you know, as part of his career, but you know, I consider Kentucky to be home. I came out of the closet here. I voted for the first time here. And I've dedicated my personal and professional career to improving the schools here in our Commonwealth. So, yeah, I'm a Kentuckian.
And your father was in that role at the University of Kentucky from, I think, 2009 to 2020. So throughout your formative years, to what extent do you think that shaped you?
You know, that's a good question. I think a couple ways. First of all, you know, my father was the first in his family ever to go to college, as was my mom, as well as to go to law school. And so to them, to our family, education has played a transformative role in what our family has been able to accomplish and where our family is today. And so he's always instilled the importance of education, both in terms of personal enrichment for me and my brothers, but also the fact that everyone should have the right and the access to the opportunities that education can afford. And, you know, that's something I've always kept to heart. But I think the other thing is he gave my brothers and I a sense of entitlement. You know, when growing up, we would have to go to him, with him to events. You know, we met Supreme Court justices and senators and representatives and governors. And, you know, I think being in those rooms, you know, even playing Xbox downstairs in the basement while a Supreme Court justice is eating dinner at our table upstairs in the dining room, you know, I think it gave my brothers and I a sense that we had the right to be in spaces, to have our voices heard, and to experience that while also in other spaces, having identities that were marginalized and being in spaces as a young person, especially with adults insisting that my voice didn't matter or that my perspective didn't matter. I think feeling that disconnect is what drove me into policy advocacy in the first place.
That's so interesting. And then you went on to help establish the Kentucky Student Voice Team. That was while you were in high school at Dunbar.
That's correct.
And that was over a decade ago. How and why, and I think you've kind of prefaced this, but how and why did you start this effort, which is to amplify and to elevate Kentucky student voices in education decision-making?
Right. So this effort started as part of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, which is a nonprofit organization that is really known nationwide for their work to improve education in the state of Kentucky. Their work really revolves around engaging all the different stakeholders, parents and teachers and business leaders who need to be at the table in terms of improving our schools. But for years, their work hadn't included who we thought were the most important stakeholders, students themselves. And so we made the case to them that we wanted to join forces as a way to ensure that students, folks who were spending 35 hours a week in the classroom, could be part of the decisions being made about how to improve that classroom. And so ever since then, that is what our work has done. It's evolved into research and policy and storytelling. But at its core, it's about honoring the agency and the expertise that students have to bring to the table when it comes to conversations about improving our public schools.
Well, making schools more just, more democratic is a pretty lofty, very ambitious goal. Can you give our listeners a little idea of what that mission looks like in practice in Kentucky?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I'll take the three buckets that I just gave you. You know, on the storytelling side, we believe that when you're telling stories about our public schools or about education, that students should be spoken to about those stories, that they should be sources in those articles. Not only that, though, you know, we think students are really capable of telling stories about our public schools. And in fact, we believe that they have the kind of access to the real challenges facing our schools that some education journalists don't, especially adult ones. And so we think that they can bring that expertise to informing the narrative and the conversation about what is going on in our public schools. We hear a lot from parents and politicians, but not enough from students themselves. And on the research side, you know, we support students not to just be subjects of education research, but to be education researchers themselves, to help co-design the questions, to help distribute the surveys, to help analyze the results. And we think when young people are involved in that process, it improves not only the quality of the research and the output itself, but also makes it more likely that the research will turn into something actionable for the school and the community to really build on. And on the policy side, you know, our schools are governed by these stakeholder committees, whether it be the school board, which is elected by the community, or the site-based decision-making councils, which are a product of the Kentucky Education Reform Act from the 90s, which are made up of teachers and parents and administrators. In each of those instances, students have a valuable perspective to bring to the table. And so our work has been to try to get students integrated into these school governing bodies as voting members with a seat at the table. And we've seen the value of that with a student on the State Board of Education over the past couple of years. Repeatedly, this member has been able, even without a vote, to bring attention to issues that are important to Kentucky students that are not on the top of the agenda of the adults in the room. So I think that kind of captures some of the work that we're about.
Do you think by involving students in research and in the decision-making process, that they become more invested in their own education and their peers' education?
I think anyone becomes more invested in a process that they get to co-create and that they're a part of imagining. That's the dynamic that we're trying to flip in our public schools. But there's another point. It's not just about being invested in our public schools or being invested in their own education. It's also about being invested in our democracy. We like to say that our public schools are meant to be incubators for our democracy. And so if we want a democracy with citizens who question authority, who can engage with others across lines of difference, who can really embrace the notions of lifelong learning, then those are the conditions that we have to cultivate in our public schools. And so that's what the work of democratizing our schools is really about. It's about strengthening not just our public school system and the outcomes for students, but our democracy as a whole.
Well, in addition to chairing the board of the Kentucky Student Voice Team, you also chair the Finance and Audit Committee of the Kentucky Higher Education Assistance Authority. What does the job involve, and what do you think makes you uniquely qualified for it?
Well, let me back up a second and maybe explain what the Kentucky Higher Education
That'd be good.
Assistance Authority does. You know, I first became aware of this agency as an undergraduate student as part of a Powerball Promise campaign that the Kentucky Student Voice Team was waging. In that instance, what we were trying to do is to get lawmakers to keep their promise and dedicate lottery revenue to education as the law prescribed for years under folks from both parties. We had been diverting money from the lottery revenue to help fill other holes in the budget, and that directly affected low-income Kentucky students who were trying to get to and through college in a situation where we have an affordability crisis. And so we were fighting to get this revenue dedicated to education, and the agency responsible for taking in this revenue from the lottery and giving it back out to education scholarships is the Kentucky Higher Education Assistance Authority. So we worked closely with them throughout that campaign to learn about the impact that their programs have. Now, I think there's one program almost all Kentuckians are aware of, and that's the KEYS program, where students can get money for their GPA or their ACT scores to be able to use in college. That's merit-based aid, which is a very important program to encourage folks to stay in Kentucky as part of their higher education experience. But the other program that I think is really important from KEA is the College Access Program and the Kentucky Tuition Grants. These are college scholarships that go to low-income Kentucky students funded by the lottery and make the difference as to whether or not a student goes to college. That's the difference between merit and need-based aid. Need-based aid decides whether a student goes to college. Merit-based aid really just decides where a student is going to go to college. And so that's some of the work that KEA does, and why I was so passionate about the agency wanting to join the board. Now, on the finance chair side, that was the result of a few different resignations at right when I joined. And so I had to step up and play this role. And I've been learning nonstop since joining the board, I think a little under a year ago. I'm the youngest person on the board. I'm one of, I think, few Black and few queer people on this board. And so I try to show up as a Kentuckian, as someone passionate about our public education system, and someone who's prepared to contribute my expertise, but also prepared to learn from those who have much more experience than I do.
Well, you also, and I swear, Andrew, I don't know when you sleep, but you also are a fellow at National Geographic. And then as part of the grant-making team at Al-Midyard Network, you helped drive significant investment into youth activism in general and something called responsible technology in particular. What exactly is that, responsible technology?
Yeah, well, you know, this is where, you know, I've been really able to find intersections in my work that's passionate about education, but that is relevant to other issue areas. And so responsible technology is about the belief that while technology has the power to contribute so much good to our society, it has just as much ability to contribute negatively to our society. And it's up to us as humans, as the folks designing and deploying this technology, to decide which direction it goes. And so just to give you an example, you know, lately I've been focusing on the intersection between unregulated social media platforms and the youth mental health crisis. You know, this is a traditionally education or youth well-being issue, maybe traditionally a technology policy issue, but directly impact one another and require advocacy around, especially oriented towards youth, to get to the policy outcomes that are going to actually help us out. So the work that I'm doing in the responsible technology movement is linked in the same way to the work that I'm doing in education policy by a belief that young people must be at the table for the discussions and the decisions that impact their lives.
What are you trying to do to direct funding to young people as leaders in responsible technology?
Well, you know, youth-led organizations like the Kentucky Student Voice Team face the same barriers that nonprofits face, but they are amplified by the fact that they are youth. These barriers range from a lack of funding, a lack of infrastructure, a lack of nonprofit registration, a lack of expertise in the operational capacities needed to run an organization. And so as a grant maker, I am trying to create the pathways for foundations and philanthropies who are interested in supporting youth, but have questions about these barriers that youth-led organizations face, trying to help them see how best to support young people in that space. So I'm trying to direct philanthropic dollars directly to youth-led organizations as a way to shift power in terms of these advocacy coalitions.
Well, throughout your time as a student in North Carolina and with the help of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, you served as a defendant intervener in the affirmative action case Students for Fair Admission versus University of North Carolina Chapel Hill. And since then, you have testified, written pointed commentaries, and you've been featured in news outlets, including the New York Times and the Washington Post. The case made its way all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and you actually watched from the gallery as the court debated the future of race-conscious admissions. Tell us more about the case that you were trying to make concerning the use of affirmative action in college admissions.
Well, you know, as I sat in the gallery watching the oral arguments, several rows in front of me were my parents, who also came to D.C., who are members of the Supreme Court Bar, and were able to watch as well. And to me, that was a reminder of the role that affirmative action has played in my family for generations, both in terms of affecting my parents' education and now affording me the opportunities to get the best world-class education that I can to effect as much change for Kentucky students. You know, when I went to UNC Chapel Hill, the school was 11% Black in a state that was 22% Black. I was one of fewer than 150 Black men in my class of 4,500. And so when I heard that a group called Students for Fair Admission was suing the university, I had assumed it was to correct those injustices. Imagine my surprise when I learned Students for Fair Admission was actually suing the university for being too diverse. You know, the idea of race-conscious admissions, I think, is important for a few different reasons. Not only because it's important that UNC itself become more diverse, but also because, you know, race is something that's pretty inextricably linked to various elements of my life, the way I interact with the world and with people, the relationships that I have. I wrote about being Black in my college admissions essay, being called an Oreo at Dunbar, which, you know, kind of meant that, you know, because I put effort in at school, that I was acting white. You know, the idea that I was Black on the outside and white on the inside. Reflecting on that experience was important to me in my college essay. And the world imagined by Students for Fair Admissions would mean that that essay would have to be redacted because it too explicitly talks about race. You know, the race is an important part of the contributions that students can make to college campuses. And so it's important that it can count in the college admissions process. But there is one more thing, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier about colleges being incubators for our democracy. In a pluralistic, multiracial democracy like ours, it is imperative that our government, business, corporate institutions reflect the diversity of this country. You know, something that the Solicitor General argued beautifully during the oral arguments, the fact that the military requires an officer corps that reflects the diversity of this country. And having diverse college campuses is what ensures that to be the case. The evidence is pretty clear that without race-conscious admissions, the number of Black students on college campuses will decline. That will have specific repercussions for our democracy. And so those are the risks that we face around affirmative action and why I've been involved in this case ever since my sophomore year of college.
What were your thoughts, Andrew, recently when the Justice Department entered into a settlement with Madison County Schools addressing intense racial harassment and hostility in its high schools? And what were the roles of two Madison County students in particular, Mariah and Macy Hill?
Mariah and Macy Hill really inspire me as student advocates. They raised their hand and actually sued the school district over the racial hostility that they were facing as students in Madison County. You know, I think a couple of things when I see that settlement. The first is just the power that students can have when they are elevated and their voices are taken seriously when it comes to identifying and addressing problems in our schools. Mariah and Macy Hill, no one you know, no one gave them permission to sue the school district. You know, they had to step up and take action. And it's, you know, reminds me of all the other students around Kentucky who have been taking similar action. I remember during the Breonna Taylor protest when students in Louisville were going straight from their graduation ceremonies to protests on the street. I remember even just recently during the legislative session, seeing students walk out of their classrooms in response to some of the anti-trans legislation being considered by our legislature. It's just a reminder that Kentucky students are not waiting for their 18th birthday or for permission from adults to take action on issues that affect their lives and that they are passionate about. And so that's just, that's one of the things that I really am looking forward to about that Madison County situation. And, you know, the final thing is just this, the role that student climate surveys played in that decision. What I just really appreciated was that the Department of Justice referred to the results of these school climate surveys as evidence of the racially hostile environment in Madison County. These are surveys mandated by the state that every student in the school has to take. And so, again, I think it's just a reminder that while it might seem like the school climate survey doesn't matter, the message I want to send to Kentucky students who are themselves encountering racially hostile environments or other kinds of problematic environments at school that are undermining their ability to learn. Take these school climate surveys seriously because the Department of Justice is watching, others are watching, and they can be used as evidence of problematic behavior.
I mentioned in the introduction that you received the highly competitive and the very prestigious Marshall Motley Scholarship from the NAACP's Legal Justice Fund. I'm told this will, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this will cover all 3 years of expenses at Columbia Law School, and then this will commit you to practice civil rights law in the South for a number of years after that. First of all, congratulations. That's amazing. But also, can you tell us more about your future plans? What can we expect next from you, Andrew?
Yeah, you know, you got it right. An incredibly generous program from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and one that you know, when I first read about online, I knew I needed to apply for and that I wanted to be a part of. I was just, I almost cried when I got the information that I got it, because it was so affirming to everything that I've dedicated my life to. I always knew that I wanted to be in Kentucky fighting for education, civil rights, and for giving me a path toward doing that, a debt-free path. You know, I'm incredibly thankful to the Legal Defense Fund. You know, the thing that I will be focusing on is what it means to have a right to education in the state of Kentucky. It's something that's in our Constitution. And, you know, as a education nerds will know that Kentucky is actually has some history in this field, having had a landmark class action decision in the 80s, followed by an overhauling of our education system through something called the Kentucky Education Reform Act. We were looked to nationally as a leader in how to reform our public schools. But, you know, since then, there's not been enough work done to really define what it means to Kentucky students to have a right to education. You know, when you have students who go through high school doing everything right, you know, graduating, you know, with their attendance record perfect, with a good GPA, and then get to community college and find themselves having to take a year of remedial courses on their own dime. You know, did that student receive their right to an education? You know, when you have suspension statistics of Black students, where you have more suspension and expulsion events of Black students than there are Black students in the school system, have you met a right to an education? And when you have, you know, queer students who aren't allowed to have a sexual health education, who aren't allowed to read about history of their people, of people who are like them, what does it mean for their right to an education? So those are the questions that will be the focus of my legal education at Columbia. And I'm so thankful to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund for giving me the opportunity to pursue them.
Well, it's good to know you, Andrew. Andrew Brennan, now on his way to a law degree from Columbia, and without a doubt, a civil rights voice that you're going to be hearing often in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up after the break, did you know the early guides at Mammoth Cave were black men?
On the surface, they were slaves, but in that cave, they were free.
A Kentucky music event in support of a Native American community in South Dakota. And a fresh voice on the Kentucky music scene.
You know, if I can write a song and make you feel a certain way that maybe you haven't felt in years, then I've done my job.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Frankfurt's Grand Theater will present the musical duo of Americana singer-songwriters Jerry Catherine Howe and Nat Colton, 10 a.m. July 18th. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit thegrandky.com. The Kentucky Arts Council is currently taking applications for its Kentucky Crafted program. Kentucky Crafted is an adjudicated program that assists Kentucky visual and craft artists through marketing, promotional opportunities, and arts business training. The application deadline is August 15th. Contact Arts Marketing Program Director Dave Blevins at david.blevins@ky.gov for more information. To learn how to support these and other arts events in Kentucky, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Sherry Lawson, now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
For Kentuckians, Mammoth Cave is sort of like what the Statue of Liberty is to New Yorkers, ever present, but a place where mostly tourists go. We know that Mammoth is just that, a huge cave system managed as a national park. But there is an important part of its history that is not known by many. And that's Gerald Smith's focus for the latest in his series on racial justice and equality.
Jerry Bransford is a fifth-generation guide at Mammoth Cave National Park. He was one of 12 students who integrated to Glasgow High School from Ralph Bunche College School in September of 1964. He graduated from Glasgow High in 1965. He went on to technical college and then was drafted into the Army in 1968 at the height of the Vietnam War. He met his wife Barbara, who lived in Glendale, and they married in 1968. After serving his country, he began a 30-year career at Dow Corning in Elizabethtown. In 2004, he began working as an interpretive ranger at Mammoth Cave. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Mr. Bransford.
Well, thank you, sir. Proud to be here.
All right. I want to begin by, you know, giving the audience an abbreviated history of Mammoth Cave. So if you would do that, please, and then you can go ahead and begin talking about some of the early guides.
Okay. Well, Mammoth Cave is the longest cave system in the known world to date, with 426 miles. The Cave Research Foundation, who are volunteers, go into the cave in dreadful, dangerous, wet, muddy places to find more caves. Each year, they add a little bit more to it, the cave, and they will be here two or three times a year, getting into deep, dark, damp places that I've been. And it's a task that's not for the faint-hearted, and you'll be surprised at people who wait in line from around the world just to go in that cave and look around. But I also will say, without going much further with this, your early explorers and guides were black men.
And now, exactly where is Mammoth Cave located?
Mammoth Cave is in South Central Kentucky. It's down I-65 at the edge, at a little bit west of Cave City. It's exit 53, and it's off Highway 70. If you come down, you'll see the signs along the interstate telling you how to get to your 26th National Park, Mammoth Cave of Kentucky.
So who were some of these early guides?
Early guides were black men. The very, very first guys were Caucasian guys who owned the cave or had lineage to it. But by 1838, the cave was up. Franklin Gorham of Glasgow had paid $5,000 for the cave with the idea that it could become a tourist attraction. So he owned a slave named Stephen Bishop. And he soon realized that a single 17-year-old couldn't possibly meet the demands of exploring and guiding and charting. So he goes to Nashville and get two other black guides. Their owner was their daddy, and they rented. Franklin Gorham of Glasgow rented two slave guys named Nick and Matt Bransford. So your early guys were black men, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And they were enslaved people, right?
Enslaved people, mm-hmm. In bondage. On the surface, they were slaves, but in that cave, they were free.
Mm-hmm.
escorting kings and queens, General George Custer, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Edwin Booth, and the list just goes on to the renowned people that depended on black men in bondage to take them on short tours of 9 hours, maybe a 15-hour long tour.
Now, you're a fifth-generation guide. Who were some of the other family members?
Well, some of the other family members were Madison Bransford, my great-great-grandfather. He married a slave girl named Parthena from Brownsville, and they asked their owners if they could jump a broomstick and get married, and they did. And to that union came four children, and by 1863, three of the four were sold. So Henry, my great-grandfather, they were able to retain him however how they did. So my great-great-grandfather married a gal named Cleo Copes, and then they had children, and all those boys were guides, and it just goes on down the line. And by 1941, there were cousins, brothers, or brothers' boys guiding the cave, Bransfords, and before they were expelled from the cave. So they were the principal guides. Will Bransford, cousins, had a joyous time. All those kin folks, all those boys worked in the cave that we were first cousins, second cousins, and nieces and nephews, so people like that.
Mm-hmm. So talk about Bransford Summer Resort.
Oh, Bransford Summer Resort. I was just down through there a couple of days ago. Matt Bransford, third generation, my great uncle, was actually great friends with estate's manager. And so they saw a need for black people to have a place to stay. So Judge Janning, who was the estate's manager, favored Matt. And Matt was kind of a companion. You know, he would go with Judge Janning to sales and things like that. And wealthy white folks would come to Mammoth Cave in the early 1900s, and these black people were serving. So Matt Bransford, third generation, my great uncle, and Judge Jennings saw a need for black people to have a place to stay. So Matt Bransford and his wife, Zimmy, built the Matt Bransford Summer Resort for colored visitors.
What did that offer? There was a place to stay?
It offered a place to stay for $2.50 a day, had clean spring water from across the field there where the springs were. It had healthy forestry, and he had an orchard where you could go down and pick your fruit. And then on Thursday nights, Matt and Zimmy would have dances down there. They'd have brass bands and all sorts of colorful things. If you came to Mammoth Cave and you were black, tell the cabbie to bring you to Matt Bransford's Summer Resort.
How far is that from the actual cave entrance?
It's probably a mile and a half.
Okay.
Up Flint Ridge, down Green Arch Road. And it was real close to Pleasant Union Baptist Church where me old folks used to go to church. My grandfather was one of the deacons, and his brother was the pastor of Pleasant Union Baptist Church that sat real close to the cemetery and close to where Matt and Zimmy Bransford's resort once was.
Now, when did you begin working as an interpretive ranger?
I began working as an interpretive ranger in March of 2004. I had a third-year career with this big company, and I was approached by Joy Lyons, who was Chief of Program Services, a dynamic black history advocate. So she found me through my father and asked me if I was interested in bringing Bransford back. So that's how I got there.
And so you have been working there now for, what, about 19 years, almost 20 years?
Yeah, 19 years. I'm 19 years I've been there, and that's been it's been the highlight of my life working down there in the cave and on the grounds. You know, the cave is important, but also I have a lot of black kin folks who live in the woods up there. So sometimes I just go up there and look around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So why did you choose to work as a guide?
Well, I chose to work as a guide because I would hear realtors talk about the heartaches and how sad it was that they were forced to leave there in the 1930s and that we had been tour guide in the cave for four generations, and after all, they were forced to leave. A lot of the white guys were grandfathered into the guide's uniform and the role as National Park Rangers, but none of the black men were. So when Joy Lyons found me, I thought I had an obligation to speak for those people who got into the cave for four generations, and they were turned away, and shortly after they left, it was as though they were never there. So I felt that I owed America that history, and I particularly owed that history to my ancestors and other black people who lived there and really didn't have much said about them.
So what have you enjoyed the most about serving as a guide?
I've enjoyed most Serpent Guide as the international community that you greet and leave in the cave. And I'm sure that my ancestors and other guides felt the same ways, that you never know who you're going to have. One of the things, and then the most joyful thing that I have is walking through the cave and seeing names of relatives on the cave walls, like 1850s, 1935s, 1914, my dad's oldest brother. And so they're gone, but I feel that they left a note there for me to read. And that great, that gives me a lot of satisfaction standing right there where they stood 150 years ago and reading their names. And I'm satisfied that they knew how to write quite well. And that's what it does for me. Yeah.
What about the black men who worked with the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s?
During the Great Depression, black men worked in a cave. Camp 535 was one camp of black men. And, of course, the park was in transition. So the government says, we might make this a 26th National Park, but those trails and the through paths of the cave has to be about the government standards. So it just so happened that the Great Depression was on. And so black men in Camp 535, the one camp, worked in the cave with pick shovels and hoes and all that, no power tools. But the unusual thing about that time in American history, that these black men, they were segregated and they had their own camp. But they were paid the same wages as white men. The president, Roosevelt, guaranteed that black men would have the same pay as the white guys for the same work.
How do you know so much about the history? Is it through oral tradition that your family members passed down that history to you?
Well, you know, a lot of things has occurred in these 19 years. Pat Bransford Davis from Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas area has Thomas Bransford's slave record books. And we know now that Thomas Bransford of Nashville was actually heir to King Henry III of England. And so he had a dynamic record book, and Mary Jane Eubanks, his sister, was his bookkeeper. So these Caucasian Bransfords in Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas area had these ledgers, and they're beautifully written. So they knew that they had lineage in Glasgow, and they came to the Grand Ole, they came to Nashville, Tennessee, to the Grand Ole Opry, and they said, well, let's go up to Glasgow to see if we can find any Bransfords. Well, they looked in the phone book, and they found my dad, David Bransford. And she says, my name is Pat Bransford Davis. I'm from Texas, Mr. Bransford. We've got some interesting historical facts about the family if you're interested in hearing them. So my dad says, well, I have a son named Jerry that lives about an hour north of here. And boy, he's been pumping me for years about the family history and things of that sort. So she called me and she shared with me just tons of valuable information about the Bransfords and about Thomas Bransford and how he owned a little slave girl named Little Hannah and how she had two children and one was Matt. And he made it clear that he knew that he was Matt's father and that Franklin Gordon and he were partners and they thought they could make money if they knew what was in the cave. And so he rented those boys to Franklin Gordon for $100 a year each, beginning in 1838. And that's how we started our family tradition, working in the cave.
Now, I know recently, well, actually several months ago, you led the dedication of the Bransford Family Monument. Where is that located? And, you know, why was it dedicated?
Well, it's the Bransford Cemetery is located at Flint Ridge down Green Onyx Road. And Joy Lyons, who was the person that hired me, she says, now, I knew that we had a cemetery up there, but I didn't know exactly where it was. And my dad was getting old, so he wasn't able to take me. So down through the woods we went, and we found this little cemetery down there with about 41 graves. And it was just overgrown, neglected, like most of the cemeteries are there, because the government only takes care of the ones on the main thoroughfare. So while up there, I had a feeling. I saw Henry Bransford's guide and his wife, Alice, and most of the graves unmarked. So I wanted to restore that cemetery. I wanted to restore it. I've been about 7 years doing that with the work of co-workers and volunteers. I wanted it to be a place, when you visit it, to be a place to celebrate versus a place that would make you sad. And also, I had the idea to put a memorial up there. I was several years getting permission from the United States government to put that obelisk up there that weighs 6,500 pounds. So last spring, we got the obelisk in the cemetery. It's been restored, and I have the names of each one of the bracelets named on the cemetery. And we have a base stone, and gladly enough, my name is the last name on there. It's Jerry Brantford, fifth generation guide in the cave, and it's a memorial that has Nick Brantford and Madison Brantford's their pictures are lasered on the headstone. It's a big rock that came from India, and we were almost 2 years getting it here. And I'm very proud of it. And the United States government, Mammoth Cave National Park, really worked hard, helped me get that road cleared, get the trees done. The volunteers helped me get everything ready for the dedication ceremony, which we had on October 15th, 2022. So I'm just happy about that. And anybody sees it, and everybody has seen it, says it really looks nice.
All right. Well, we're very grateful for the contributions of the Brantford family to the history of Mammoth Cave Historical Park. That's Jerry Brantford, interpretive ranger and guide at Mammoth Cave. I'm Gerald Smith with Eastern Standard.
Deep in Kentucky, down in Mammoth Cave, don't you ever enter or you'll lose your way. There's thousands of tunnels, you'll be trapped in a maze. Deep in Kentucky, down in Mammoth Cave.
A band, an orchestra really, made up of some of Lexington's most talented musicians, is getting ready for a benefit concert on July 22nd at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center. And while the music is to be made in Lexington, it's in harmony with a cause 1,200 miles away. On the line with us is Paul Mertali, organizer for the upcoming concert, Walking with Our Ancestors. It's happening on July 22nd at the Pam Miller Center for the Arts in downtown Lexington. Thanks for joining us, Palmer.
I'm happy to be here.
And so first tell us what this is about, Walking with Our Ancestors.
Well, it's, I think, a very important and worthy event. A friend of mine, Janet Quigg, and she's well known as the vice chair for the Richmond Powwow and has been a part of that for over 25 years. And she was discussing with me some of the needs of her friends on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And she has very close ties. And one friend in particular is Delaney Apple. And he does amazing work with the youth. He helps them stay out of gangs and any negative influences through his mentorship as a teacher and guide for the youth there in the in their cultural history and teaching them positive ways to adapt to the today's societies with Native American traditions.
And Delaney is Oglala Lakota, is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
It's interesting to me that there's an event in Kentucky on behalf of Pine Ridge Reservation. What is the connection?
Oh, well, the connection is actually Janet Quigg, who, through her powwow, she's made many close friends over the many years and is very active with the various tribes. And it is through her is the connection.
Will this be a fundraiser?
Yes, this is a benefit. And it's very exciting because we hope that we can raise money that will that is direly needed on the reservation. And so that's why we're selling tickets and presenting a musical event. This is definitely a benefit event.
And let's talk about that music. The Metropolitan Contemporary Jazz Orchestra, right?
That is correct.
Tell us about that.
Well, this is our premier performance on July 22nd, and it is the vision and dream of Paul Osborne. He's always held this thought that he wanted to have a jazz orchestra, and so this provided an opportunity for us and motivated us to actually step forward in the organization of it. It's very exciting music.
And what kind of music? Who are you playing?
Oh, we have some of the music of groups like Spiral Gyra, which is just fun, fusion music and the Rippingtons. And if anybody is not familiar, look them up because they're excellent. And the music of Dave Cause, Paul does favor his style a lot. And we have Bob Bryant, who I think is well known in the area.
Fantastic bass player.
Yes. Yeah. He is our conductor. And then Jesse Penna on guitar, Tom Cavella on bass, Dave Hammond on drums, Paul on sax and flute, and I am the keyboard player. And we are augmented, this core group, by a string section, and most joyfully, the Diana Mapson Chamber Choir.
How about tickets? Are they available ahead of time?
Yes, they are, and we recommend that that's how people acquire their seating. Go ahead and call the box office and get your tickets now.
Okay, and that number is 859-425-2550. They're also online as well. Palmer Tolley, thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to the event.
Thank you, Tom.
Some of us here at Eastern Standard have what you might call a side hustle, music. We love it. And that includes reporter Crystal Jones, who rarely misses a music festival in the region and is always listening for emerging talent. Crystal was in Slade, Kentucky, near the Red River Gorge for the recent Festival of the Red.
Festival season is in full swing across the bluegrass, and every season there are a new group of artists who emerge onto the local music scene for the first time. Enveloping lyrics and new perspective on some old chords, Hannah Howard is this year's newest performer on the festival circuit, where we caught up with her after her performance at Festival of the Red this year in Slade, Kentucky. Hannah's stage presence is thoughtful, and her lyrics combined with a vocal range and style that's been sadly missing from the scene since the late 90s. Her sound is both fresh and familiar. Hannah is currently working on her first album, from which she played a few songs during the singer-songwriter round on Saturday. We're talking to her about her creative process and the experience of playing local festivals.
And you were from around the Mount Vernon area, is that right?
I grew up in Broadhead, so Barcastle County, Renfrew Valley area, you know, spent basically my whole life there. I now live in Knoxville, but I'm originally from that area in Kentucky.
Okay, so how long have you been playing publicly?
I started in September of last year.
So what made you choose to do this?
Honestly, my whole life, I never thought that music was an option for me. I never thought that it was something that I would be able to do. I guess maybe it was something within myself, insecurities, just lacking confidence in myself. I think once you start to love yourself, you start to build that confidence. And I think that's been my biggest lesson of the year, is learning to love who I am. Mm-hmm. And fully embrace and accept myself. And I want to do something that I love and something I enjoy, because we only have so much time here on this earth, and why not do the thing that you love, you know?
Who are some of your influences? What do you like to listen to? Because I heard a lot of different things in your voice when you're up there. I heard everything from a Dolly to a little like Cranberries-esque yeah. kind of feel. So where do you land at? What do you like to listen to?
That's so sweet. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I love all genres of music. I think growing up, I loved James Taylor, Bob Dylan. Emmylou Harris is someone that I've recently gotten into. I never listened to before. My influences are just so, I don't know if I can pinpoint one really, or I don't even think I could pinpoint five. I mean, I listen to a lot of music, and it's always evolving and changing. And honestly, like, I love music that's totally different from anything that I write or I play, but I appreciate all music.
How does a festival differ from playing a venue?
So for me, I personally prefer festivals or listening rooms. Specifically for this festival, one thing I appreciated, which Corduroy Brown had mentioned on the mic, was how everyone is very intentional about listening. I think that that's why festivals like this are so important, because it gives a platform for people that don't always get to get heard. You know, people that are songwriters, people that are kind of behind the scenes. So I love that, and paying attention to the songwriters and what they have to say. They're not just there to party. They're not just there to dance. They're there to listen. And that's why I love festivals. And you also get to network and meet so many new people and grow your fan base and supporters, and it's your friendships and your communities. And so for me, like, playing festivals and playing listening rooms are like so fulfilling, and it's just some of the best experiences because people actually are listening and you're able to really make somebody feel something. You're able to make an impact on somebody's life. You know, if I can write a song and make you feel a certain way that maybe you haven't felt in years, then I've done my job. And that's all that matters, for me at least. It's just making people feel and connect. As we grow and we connect, I think we realize that we are all one. We're just one big family. We're one big community because at the end of the day, all we have is each other. We don't have anything else.
Lyrically, your songs are beautiful. They're very real, very emotional, very real life experience. And when you're writing, what's your process like?
An idea or a feeling that I have, sometimes I'll write something down and forget about it, and then I'll go back to it and I'll finish it. A lot of my songs just come from my personal experiences, just things that I've been through. Sometimes I've really been trying to be more intentional with songwriting, like sitting down and be like, all right, let's write something based on this feeling that you're having or based on, you know, this idea that you have. And so I've been trying to be more intentional with that, but for the most part, it's usually like on the spot kind of thing, so. Mm.
You're performing at Master Musicians.
Yes, I'm so honored to be on that lineup. It's such a big deal for me in my career and in my, you know, for myself, just personally. It's a big accomplishment.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Hannah Howard.
Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Hannah Howard at Festival of the Red in Slade, Kentucky. For Eastern Standard, this is Crystal Jones.
Hannah Howard recently performed live on WDVX Richmond's Blue Plate Special. And let's close out the hour with a listen to her song about a loved one who had slipped into dementia.
I think anyone who has family members or loved ones that battle that disease know what I mean when I say that you lose them before you really lose them. And it's a really, really, really awful disease. It's a different type of grieving, a different type of mourning. But I wrote this song of all of our accounts that I spent all my summers with him as a kid growing up. So everything in this song is 100% true.
Remember when I was a little girl, so brave and unafraid of the world, 3 foot tall, sitting in your lap. Do you remember that? And you'd throw a line and I'd catch a fish. You'd jump in the water and wrestle with alligators. Thought you were crazy.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Crystal Jones, general assignment reporter, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard online at weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.